Side 5. The cab dropped us at Rockfish Gap, southern gateway to Shenandoah National Park. I was looking forward to the park because it is exceptionally beautiful. That is why it is a national park, of course. But filled with mild disquiet at the prospect of spending the next 7 or 8 nights and 101 miles under the yoke of National Park Service rules. At Rockfish Gap, there is a toll booth manned by rangers, where motorists have to pay an entrance fee and thru-hikers have to acquire a backcountry hiking permit. The permit doesn't cost anything. One of the noblest traditions of the Appalachian Trail is that every inch of it is free. But you have to complete a lengthy form, giving your personal details, your itinerary through the park, and where you plan to camp each night, which is a little ridiculous because you haven't seen the terrain and don't know what kind of mileage you might achieve. Appended to the form were the usual copious regulations and warnings of severe fines and immediate banishment for doing, well, pretty much anything. I filled out the form as best I could and handed it in at the window to a lady ranger. "So, you're hiking the trail?" she said brightly, if not terribly astutely, accepted the form without looking at it, banged it severely with rubber stamps, and tore off the part that would serve as our license to walk on land that, in theory, we owned anyway. "Well, we're trying," I said. "I must get up there myself one of these days. I hear it's real nice." This took me aback. "You've never been on the trail?" "But you're a ranger," I wanted to say. "No, afraid not," she answered wistfully. "Lived here all my life, but haven't got to it yet. One day I will." Katz, mindful of Beulah's husband, was practically dragging me towards the safety of the woods, but I was curious. "How long have you been a ranger?" I called back. 12 years in August," she said proudly. "You ought to give it a try sometime. It's real nice." "Might get some of that flab off your butt," Katz muttered privately and stepped into the woods. I looked at him with interest and surprise. It wasn't like Katz to be so uncharitable, and put it down to lack of sleep, profound sexual frustration, and a surfeit of Hardee's sausage biscuits. Shenandoah National Park is a park with problems. More even than the Smokies, it suffers from a chronic shortage, though a cynic might say a chronic misapplication, of funds. Several miles of side trails have been closed, and others are deteriorating. If it weren't that volunteers from the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club maintain 80% of the park's trails, including the whole of the AT through the park, the situation would be much worse. Matthews Arm Campground, one of the park's main recreational areas, was closed for lack of funds in 1993 and hasn't been open since. Several other recreation areas are closed for most of the year. For a time in the 1980s, even the trail shelters, or huts as they are known here, were shut. I don't know how they did it. I mean to say, how exactly do you close a wooden structure with a 15-foot-wide opening at the front? And still less, why? Since forbidding hikers from resting a few hours on a wooden sleeping platform is hardly going to transform the park's finances. But then, making things difficult for hikers is something of a tradition in the eastern parks. A couple of months earlier, all the national parks, along with all other non-essential government departments, had been closed for a couple of weeks during a budget impasse between President Clinton and Congress. Yet Shenandoah, despite its perennial want of money, found the funds to post a warden at each AT access point to turn back all thru-hikers. In consequence, a couple of dozen harmless people had to make lengthy, pointless detours by road before they could resume their long hike. This vigilance couldn't have cost the Park Service less than $20,000, or the better part of $1,000 for each dangerous thru-hiker deflected. On top of its self-generated shortcomings, Shenandoah has a lot of problems arising from factors largely beyond its control. Overcrowding is one. Although the park is over 100 miles long, it is almost nowhere more than a mile or two wide. So all its 2 million annual visitors are crowded into a singularly narrow corridor along the ridgeline. Campgrounds, visitor centers, car parks, picnic sites, the AT, and Skyline Drive, the scenic road that runs down the spine of the park, all exist cheek by jowl. One of the most popular non-AT hiking routes in the park, up Old Rag Mountain, has become so much in demand that on summer weekends, people sometimes have to queue to get on it. Then there is the vexed matter of pollution. 30 years ago, it was still possible, on especially clear days, to see the Washington Monument, 75 miles away. Now, on hot, smoggy summer days, visibility can be as little as 2 miles, and never more than 30. Acid rain in the streams has nearly wiped out the park's trout. Gypsy moths arrived in 1983, and have since ravaged considerable acreages of oaks and hickories. The southern pine beetle has done similar work on conifers, and the locust leaf miner has inflicted disfiguring, but mercifully usually non-fatal, damage on thousands of locust trees. In just 7 years, the woolly adelgid has fatally damaged more than 90% of the park's hemlocks. Nearly all the rest will be dying by the time you read this. An untreatable fungal disease, called anthracnose, is wiping out the lovely dogwoods, not just here, but everywhere in America. Before long, the dogwood, like the American chestnut and American elm, will effectively cease to exist. It would be hard, in short, to conceive a more stressed environment. And yet here is the thing. Shenandoah National Park is lovely. It is possibly the most wonderful national park I've ever been in, and considering the impossible and conflicting demands put on it, it is extremely well run. Almost at once, it became my favorite part of the Appalachian Trail. We hiked through deep-seeming woods, along gloriously untaxing terrain, climbing a gentle 500 feet in 4 miles. In the Smokies, you can climb 500 feet in, well, about 500 feet. This was more like it. The weather was kindly, and there was a real sense of spring being on the turn. And there was life everywhere, zumming insects, squirrels scampering along boughs, birds twittering and hopping about, spiders' webs gleaming silver in the sun. Twice I flushed grouse, always a terrifying experience, an instantaneous explosion from the undergrowth at your feet, like bald socks fired from a gun, followed by drifting feathers and a lingering residue of fussy, bitching noise. I saw an owl, which watched me imperturbably from a near stout limb, and loads of deer, which raised their heads to stare but otherwise seemed fearless, and casually returned to their browsing when I had passed. 60 years ago, there were no deer in this neck of the Blue Ridge Mountains. They had been hunted out of existence. Then, after the park was created in 1936, 13 white-tailed deer were introduced. And with no one to hunt them and few predators, they thrived. Today there are 5,000 deer in the park, all descended from those original 13, or others that migrated from nearby. Surprisingly, considering its modest dimensions and how little room there is for real backcountry, the park is remarkably rich in wildlife. Bobcats, bears, red and gray foxes, beaver, skunks, raccoons, flying squirrels, and our friends the salamanders exist in admirable numbers, though you don't often see them, as most are nocturnal or wary of people. Shenandoah is said to have the highest density of black bears anywhere in the world, slightly over 1 per square mile. There have even been reported sightings, including by park rangers who perhaps ought to know better, of mountain lions, even though mountain lions haven't been confirmed in the eastern woods for almost 70 years. There is the tiniest chance that they may exist in pockets in the northern woods. We shall get to that in due course, and I think you'll be glad you waited, but not in an area as small and hemmed in as Shenandoah National Park. We didn't see anything terribly exotic, or even remotely exotic, but it was nice just to see squirrels and deer, to feel that the forest was lived in. Late in the afternoon, I rounded a bend to find a wild turkey and her chicks crossing the trail ahead of me. The mother was regal and unflappable. Her chicks were much too busy falling over and getting up again even to notice me. This was the way the woods were supposed to be. I couldn't have been more delighted. We hiked till 5, and camped beside a tranquil spring in a small grassy clearing in the trees just off the trail. Because it was our first day back on the trail, we were flush for food, including perishables like cheese and bread that had to be eaten before they went off or were shaken to bits in our packs, so we rather gorged ourselves, then sat around smoking and chatting idly until persistent and numerous midge-like creatures, no-see-ums as they are universally known along the trail, drove us into our tents. It was perfect sleeping weather, cool enough to need a bag, but warm enough to sleep in your underwear, and I was looking forward to a long night's snooze, indeed was enjoying a long night's snooze, when at some indeterminate dark hour there was a sound nearby that made my eyes fly open. Normally I slept through everything, through thunderstorms, through cats' snoring and noisy midnight peas, so something big enough or distinctive enough to wake me was unusual. There was a sound of undergrowth being disturbed, a click of breaking branches, a weighty pushing through low foliage, and then a kind of large, vaguely irritable, snuffling noise. Bear. I sat bolt upright. Instantly, every neuron in my brain was awake and dashing around frantically like ants when you disturb their nest. I reached instinctively for my knife, then realized I'd left it in my pack, just outside the tent. Nocturnal defense had ceased to be a concern after many successive nights of tranquil woodland repose. There was another noise quite near. "Stephen, you awake?" I whispered.
"Yep," he replied in a weary but normal voice.
"What was that?"
"How the hell should I know?"
"It sounded big."
"Everything sounds big in the woods."
This was true. Once a skunk had come plodding through our camp, and it had sounded like a stegosaurus. There was another heavy rustle, and then the sound of lapping at the spring. It was having a drink, whatever it was. I shuffled on my knees to the foot of the tent, cautiously unzipped the mesh and peered out. But it was pitch black. As quietly as I could, I brought in my backpack, and with the light of a small torch, searched through it for my knife. When I found it and opened the blade, I was appalled at how wimpy it looked. It was a perfectly respectable appliance for, say, buttering pancakes, but patently inadequate for defending oneself against 400 pounds of ravenous fur. Carefully, very carefully, I climbed from the tent and put on the torch, which cast a distressingly feeble beam. Something about 15 or 20 feet away looked up at me. I couldn't see anything at all of its shape or size, only two shining eyes. It went silent, whatever it was, and stared back at me. "Stephen," I whispered at his tent, "did you pack a knife?"
"No."
"Have you got anything sharp at all?"
He thought for a moment. "Nail clippers." I made a despairing face.
"Anything a little more vicious than that? Because you see, there is definitely something out here."
"It's probably just a skunk."
"Then it's one big skunk. Its eyes are 3 feet off the ground."
"A deer, then."
I nervously threw a stick at the animal, and it didn't move, whatever it was. A deer would have bolted. This thing just blinked once and kept staring. I reported this to Katz.
Probably a buck. They're not so timid.
Try shouting at it. I cautiously shouted at it. "Hey! You there! Scat!" The creature blinked again, singularly unmoved. "You shout," I said.
"Oh, you brute! Go away! Do!"
Katz shouted in merciless imitation.
"Please withdraw at once, you horrid creature!"
"Fuck you," I said, and lugged my tent right over to his. I didn't know what this would achieve exactly, but it brought me a tiny measure of comfort to be nearer to him.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm moving my tent."
"Oh, good plan. That'll really confuse it."
I peered and peered, but I couldn't see anything but those two wide-set eyes staring from the near distance like eyes in a cartoon. I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be outside and dead or inside and waiting to be dead. I was barefoot and in my underwear and shivering. What I really wanted, really, really wanted, was for the animal to withdraw. I picked up a small stone and tossed it at it. I think it may have hit it, because the animal made a sudden noisy start, which scared the bejesus out of me, and brought a whimper to my lips, and then it emitted a noise. Not quite a growl,
but near enough. It occurred to me that perhaps I oughtn't to provoke it. What are you doing, Bryson? Just leave it alone and it will go away. How can you be so calm? What do you want me to do? You're hysterical enough for both of us. I think I have a right to be a trifle alarmed, pardon me. I'm in the woods, in the middle of nowhere, in the dark, staring at a bear, with a guy who has nothing to defend himself with but a pair of nail clippers. Let me ask you this. If it is a bear and it comes for you, what are you going to do? Give it a pedicure?
I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, Cat said implacably.
What do you mean you'll cross that bridge? We're on the bridge, you moron! There's a bear out here, for Christ's sake. He's looking at us. He smells noodles and Snickers and... Oh, shit.
What?
Oh, shit.
What?
There's two of them. I can see another pair of eyes.
Just then, the torch battery started to go. The light flickered and then vanished. I scampered into my tent, stabbing myself lightly but hysterically in the thigh as I went, and began a quietly frantic search for spare batteries. If I were a bear, this would be the moment I would choose to lunge.
Well, I'm going to sleep, he announced.
Talking.
Sure I can. I've done it lots of times.
There was the sound of him rolling over and a series of snuffling noises, not unlike those of the creature outside.
Stephen, you can't go to sleep, I ordered.
But he could, and he did, with amazing rapidity. The creatures now, resumed drinking, with heavy lapping noises. I couldn't find any replacement battery, so I flung the torch aside and put my miner's lamp on my head, made sure it worked, then switched it off. Then I sat for ages on my knees, facing the front of the tent, listening keenly, gripping my walking stick like a club, ready to beat back an attack, and with my knife open and at hand as a lamination of defense.
But you listened.
But the forest turned silent and stayed there. Eventually, I loosened my grip on the walking stick and put on a sweater, pausing twice to examine the tiniest noises, dreading the sound of sound. Majors it. And after a long time, were got an old sleeping bag for warmth.
There's total black.
I fell asleep. Chapter 12. I'd expected Katz to be insufferable in the morning, but in fact, he was surprisingly gracious. He called me for coffee, and when I emerged, feeling wretched and cheated of sleep, he said to me, "You okay? You look like shit." "Didn't get enough sleep," he nodded. "So you think it really was a bear?" "Who knows?" I suddenly thought of the food bag. That's what bears normally go for, and spun my head to see. But it was still suspended a dozen or so feet from the ground from a branch about 20 yards away. Probably a determined bear could have got it down. Actually, my grandmother could have got it down.
Maybe not, I said, disappointed. "Well, you know what I've got in here just in case," Katz said, and tapped his shirt pocket significantly. "Toenail clippers. Because you just never know when danger might arise. I've learned my lesson, believe me, buddy." Then he guffawed.
So we returned to the woods. For virtually the length of Shenandoah National Park, the AT closely parallels and often crosses Skyline Drive, though most of the time you would scarcely guess it. Often you will be plodding through the sanctuary of woods when suddenly a car will sail past through the trees only 40 or 50 feet away, a perennially startling sight. In the early 1930s, the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club, which was Myron Avery's baby and for a time was virtually indistinguishable from the Appalachian Trail Conference itself, came under attack from other hiking groups, particularly the Patrician Appalachian Mountain Club in Boston, for not resisting the building of Skyline Drive through the park. Stung by these rebukes, Avery sent Mackay a deeply insulting letter in December 1935, which effectively terminated Mackay's official, but even then peripheral, relationship with the trail.
The two men never spoke again. Though to his credit, Mackay paid Avery a warm tribute on his death in 1952, and generously noted that the trail could not have been built without him. A lot of people still dislike the highway, but Katz and I quite warmed to it. Frequently, we would leave the trail and hike on the road for an hour or two. This early in the season, it was still early April, there were hardly any cars on the road, so we treated Skyline Drive as a kind of broad, paved, alternative footpath. It was novel to have something firm underfoot, and exceedingly agreeable to be out in the open, in warm sunshine, after weeks in impenetrable woods. Motorists certainly had a more cosseted, looked-after existence than we did. There were frequent expansive overlooks with splendid views, though even now, in clear spring weather, blanketed with a dirty haze beyond about 6 or 7 miles. Information boards giving helpful facts on the park's wildlife and flora, and even litter bins. We could do with some of this on the trail, we agreed. And then when the sun got too hot, or our feet grew sore, for asphalt is surprisingly hard on the feet, or we just fancied a change, we would return to the familiar, cool, embracing woods. It was very agreeable, almost rakish, to have options. At one of the Skyline Drive lay-bys we came to, an information board was angled to direct the reader's attention to a nearby slope, handsomely spread with hemlocks, a very dark, almost black native conifer particularly characteristic of the Blue Ridge. All these hemlocks and all the hemlocks everywhere along the trail and far beyond are being killed by an aphid introduced accidentally from Asia in 1924. The National Park Service, the board noted sadly, could not afford to treat the trees. There were too many of them over too wide an area to make a spraying program practicable. Well, here's an idea. Why not treat some of the trees? Why not treat a tree? The good news, according to the board, was that the National Park Service hoped that some of the trees would stage a natural recovery over time. Well, whew, for that! 60 years ago, there were almost no trees on the Blue Ridge Mountains. All this was farmland. Often in the woods now, the trail would follow the relics of old stone field walls. And once we passed a small remote cemetery, reminders that this was one of the few mountaintop areas in the entire Appalachian chain where people once actually lived. Unluckily for them, they were the wrong kind of people. In the 1920s, sociologists and other academics from the cities ventured into the hills, and they were invariably appalled at what they found. Poverty and deprivation were universal. The land was ridiculously poor. Many people were farming slopes that were practically perpendicular. Three-quarters of the people in the hills couldn't read. Most had barely gone to school. Illegitimacy was 90%. Sanitation was practically unknown. Only 10% of households had even a basic privy. On top of that, the Blue Ridge Mountains were sensationally beautiful and conveniently sited for the benefit of a new class of motoring tourist. The obvious solution was to move the people off the mountaintops and into the valleys, where they could be poor lower down, build a scenic highway for people to cruise up and down on Sundays, and turn the whole thing into a great mountaintop fun zone, with commercial campgrounds, restaurants, ice cream parlors, crazy golf, helter-skelters, and whatever else might turn a snappy dollar. Unfortunately for the entrepreneurs, then came the Great Depression, and the commercial impulse withered. Instead, under that dizzying socialist impulse, though you must never use that term, that marked the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, the land was bought for the nation. The people were moved out, and the Civilian Conservation Corps was put to work building pretty stone bridges, picnic shelters, visitor centers, and much else, and the whole was open to the public in July 1936. It is the quality of craftsmanship that accounts substantially for the glory of Shenandoah National Park. Indeed, it is one of the very few examples of human handiwork, Hoover Dam is another, and Mount Rushmore I would submit as a third, anywhere in the United States, that complements, even enhances, a natural landscape. I suppose that, too, is one reason I liked walking along Skyline Drive, with its broad, lawn-like grass verges and stone retaining walls, its clusters of artfully planted birches, its gentle curves leading to arresting, thoughtfully composed panoramas. This is the way all highways should be. For a time, it looked as if all highways would be like this. It is no accident that the first highways in America were called parkways. That's what they were envisioned to be, parks you could drive through. Almost none of this spirit of craftsmanship is evident on the AT in the park. You wouldn't expect it to be on a trail devoted to wilderness. But it is agreeably encountered in the park shelters, or huts, which have something of the picturesque rusticity of the Smoky shelters, but are airier, cleaner, and better designed, and without those horrible, depressing chain-link fences across their fronts. Though Katz thought I was preposterous, I insisted on sleeping at shelters after our night at the spring. I somehow felt I could defend a shelter against marauding bears, and in any case, the Shenandoah shelters were too nice not to use. Every one of them was attractive, thoughtfully sited, had a good water source, and a picnic table and privy. For two nights, we had shelters to ourselves, and on the third, we're just exchanging congratulations on this remarkable string of luck, when we heard a cacophony of voices approaching through the woods. We peeked round the corner and found a Boy Scout troop marching into the clearing. They said hello, and we said hello, and then we sat with our legs dangling from the sleeping platform and watched them fill the clearing with their tents and abundant gear, pleased to have something to look at other than each other. There were 3 adult supervisors and 17 Boy Scouts, all charmingly incompetent. Tents went up, then swiftly collapsed or keeled over. One of the adults went off to filter water and fell in the creek. Even Katz agreed that this was better than TV. For the first time since we had left New Hampshire, we felt like masters of the trail. A few minutes later, a cheerful lone hiker arrived. His name was John Conley, and he was a high school teacher from upstate New York. He had been hiking the trail, evidently only a couple of miles behind us, for 4 days, and had been camping alone in the open each night, which struck me now as awfully brave. He hadn't seen any bears. Indeed, had been section hiking the trail for years and had seen a bear only once, briefly rump-end and fleeing deep in the Maine woods. He was followed shortly after by 2 men about our age from Louisville, Jim and Chuck, both real nice fellows, self-effacing and funny. We hadn't seen more than 3 or 4 hikers since leaving Waynesboro, and now suddenly we were inundated. "What day is it?" I asked, and everyone had to stop and think. "Friday," someone said. "Yeah, Friday." That explained it. The start of a weekend. We all sat around the picnic table, cooking and eating. It was wonderfully convivial. The 3 others had hiked a great deal and told us all about the trail ahead as far as Maine, which still seemed as distant as the next cosmos. Then the conversation turned to a perennial favorite among hikers, how crowded the trail had become. Conley talked about how he had hiked nearly half the trail in 1987 at the height of summer and had gone days without seeing anyone. And Jim and Chuck heartily seconded this. This is something you hear a lot, and it is certainly true, that more people are hiking than ever before. Until the 1970s, fewer than 50 people a year thru-hiked the AT. As recently as 1984, the number was just 100. By 1990, it had pushed past 200. And today, it is approaching 300. These are big increases, but they are also still tiny, tiny numbers. Just before we set off, my local newspaper in New Hampshire had an interview with a trail maintainer who noted that 20 years ago, the 3 campsites in his section averaged about 12 visitors a week in July and August, and that now they sometimes got as many as 100 in a week. The amazing thing about that, if you ask me, is that they got so few for so long. Anyway, 100 visitors a week for 3 campsites at the height of summer hardly seems overwhelming. Perhaps I was coming at this from the wrong direction, having hiked in crowded little England for so long, but what never ceased to astonish me throughout our long summer was how empty the trail was. Nobody knows how many people hike the Appalachian Trail, but most estimates put the number at around 3 or 4 million a year. If 4 million is right, and we assume that probably 3/4 of that hiking is done during the 6 warmest months, That means an average of 16,500 people on the trail a day in season, or 7.5 people for each mile of trail, one person every 700 feet. In fact, few sections will experience anything like that high a density. A very high proportion of those 4 million annual hikers will be concentrated in certain popular places for a day or a weekend. The Presidential Range in New Hampshire, Baxter State Park in Maine, Mount Greylock in Massachusetts, in the Smokies and Shenandoah National Park. That 4 million will also include a high proportion of what you might call Reebok hikers, people who park their car, walk 400 yards, get back in their car and drive off, and never do anything as breathtaking as that again. Believe me, no matter what anyone tells you, the Appalachian Trail is not crowded. When people bleat on about the trail being too crowded, what they mean is that the shelters are too crowded, and this is indubitably sometimes so. The problem, however, is not that there are too many hikers for the shelters, but too few shelters for the hikers. Shenandoah National Park has just 8 huts, each able to accommodate no more than 8 people in comfort, 10 at a pinch, in 101 miles of national park. That's about average for the trail overall. Although the distances between shelters can vary enormously, there is on average an AT shelter, cabin, hut, or lean-to, 240 of them altogether, about every 10 miles. That means adequate covered sleeping space for just 2,500 hikers over 2,200 miles of trail. When you consider that more than 100 million Americans live within a day's drive of the Appalachian Trail, it is hardly surprising that 2,500 sleeping spaces is sometimes not enough. Yet perversely, pressure is growing in some quarters to reduce the number of shelters, to discourage what is seen, amazingly to me, as overuse of the trail. So, as always, when the conversation turned to the crowdedness of the trail, and the fact that you now sometimes see a dozen people in a day, when formerly you would have been lucky to see 2, I listened politely and said, "You guys ought to try hiking in England." Jim turned to me and said in a kindly, patient way, "But you see, Bill, we're not in England." Perhaps he had a point. Now, here is another reason I am very, very fond of Shenandoah National Park, and why I am probably not cut out to be a proper American trail hiker. Cheeseburgers. You can get cheeseburgers quite regularly in Shenandoah National Park, and Coca-Cola with ice, and French fries, and ice cream, and a good deal else. Although the rampant commercialization I spoke of a moment ago never happened, and thank goodness, of course, something of that esprit de commerce lives on in Shenandoah. The park is liberally sprinkled with public campgrounds and rest stops with restaurants and shops, and the AT, God bless it, pays nearly every one of them a call. It is entirely against the spirit of the AT to have restaurant breaks along the trail, but I never met a hiker who didn't appreciate it to bits. Katz, Connolly, and I had our first experience of it the next morning, after we had said farewell to Jim and Chuck and the Boy Scouts, who were all headed south, when we arrived about lunchtime at a lively commercial sprawl called Big Meadows. Big Meadows had a campground, a lodge, a restaurant, a gift shop stroke general store, and lots of people spread around a big, sunny, grassy space. Although it is a big meadow, it was actually named for a guy named Meadows, which pleased me very much for some reason. We dropped our packs on the grass outside and hastened into the busy restaurant, where we greedily partook of everything greasy, then repaired to the lawn to smoke and burp and enjoy a spell of tranquil digestion. As we lay there propped against our packs, a tourist in an unfortunate straw hat, clutching an ice cream, came up and looked us over in a friendly manner. "So, you fellows hiking?" he said. We said we were. "And you carry those packs?" "Until we find someone to carry them for us," said Katz cheerfully. "How far you come this morning?" "Oh, about 8 miles."
8 miles, Lord! And how far'll you go this afternoon?"
"Oh, maybe another 8 miles."
"No kidding! 16 miles on foot. With those things on your back, man, ain't that a kick?"
he called across the lawn.
"Bernice, Come here a minute. You got to see this.
He looked at us again.
So what do you got in there? Clothes and stuff, I suppose?
And food, said Connolly.
You carry your own food, huh?
Have to.
Well, ain't that a kick?
Bernice arrived, and he explained to her that we were using our legs to proceed across the landscape.
Ain't that something? They got all their food and everything in those packs.
Is that a fact? Bernice said with admiration and interest. So you're, like, walking everywhere?
We nodded.
You walked here, all the way up here?
We walk everywhere, said Kat solemnly.
You never walked all the way up here.
Well, we did, said Katz, for whom this was becoming one of the proudest moments of his life. I went off to call home from a payphone and use the gents. When I returned a few minutes later, Katz had accumulated a small, appreciative crowd and was demonstrating the use and theory of various straps and toggles on his backpack. Then, at someone's behest, he put the pack on and posed for pictures. I had never seen him so happy. While he was still occupied, Connolly and I went into the little grocery part of the complex to have a look around, and I realized just how little regarded and incidental hikers are to the real business of the park. Only 3% of Shenandoah's 2 million annual visitors go more than a few yards into what is generously termed the backcountry. 90% of visitors arrive in cars or motorhomes. This was a store for them. Nearly everything in the store required microwaving or oven heating or scrupulous refrigeration or came in large family-sized quantities. It's a rare hiker who wants 24 hamburger buns, I find. There was not a single item of conventional trail food, raisins or peanuts or small portable quantities of packets or tinned goods, which was a little dispiriting in a national park. With no choice and desperate not to eat noodles again if we could possibly help it, Connolly, I was delighted to learn, was also a noodles man, we bought 24 hot dogs and matching buns, a 2-liter bottle of Coke, and a couple of large packets of cookies. Then we collected Katz, who announced regretfully to his adoring audience that he had to go, there were mountains still to climb, and stepped valiantly back into the woods. We stopped for the night at a lovely, secluded spot called Rock Spring Hut, perched on a steep hillside with a long view over the Shenandoah Valley far below. The shelter even had a swing, a 2-seater that hung on chains from the shelter overhang, put there in memory of one Teresa Affronti, who had loved the trail, according to the plaque on its back, which I thought was rather splendid. Earlier visitors to the shelter had left behind an assortment of tinned foods, beans, corn, spam, baby carrots, which were lined carefully along one of the support rafters. You find this sort of thing quite a lot on the trail. In some places, friends of the trail will hike up to shelters with homemade cookies or platters of fried chicken. It's quite wonderful. While we were cooking dinner, a young southbound thru-hiker, the first of the season, arrived. He had hiked 26 miles that day and thought he had died and gone to heaven when he learned that hot dogs were on the menu. 6 hot dogs apiece was more than Katz and Connolly and I could eat, so we ate 4, and a quantity of cookies, and saved the rest for breakfast. But the young southbounder ate as if he had never eaten before. He downed 6 hot dogs, then a tin of baby carrots, and gratefully accepted a dozen or so Oreos, one after the other, and ate them with a great savor and particularity. He told us he had started in Maine in deep snow, and had been endlessly caught in blizzards, but was still averaging 25 miles a day. He was only about 5'6", and his pack was enormous. No wonder he had an appetite. He was trying to hike the trail in 3 months, mostly by putting in very long days. When we woke in the morning, dawn was only just leaking in, but he had already gone. Where he had slept, there was a brief note thanking us for the food and wishing us luck. We never did learn his name. Late the next morning, when I realized that I had considerably outstripped Katz and Connolly, who were talking and not making very good time, I stopped to wait for them in a spacious, sun-dappled dell tucked into a bowl of small hills, which gave it an enchanting, secretive feel. Everything you might ask of a woodland scene was there: musical brook, carpet of lush ferns, elegant, well-spaced trees, and it struck me in passing what a nice place this would be to camp. Just over a month later, Two young women, Lolly Winans and Julianne Williams, evidently had the same thought. They pitched their tents somewhere in this tranquil, airy grove, then hiked the short way through the woods to Skyland Lodge, another commercial complex, to eat in its restaurant. No one knows exactly what happened, but some person at Skyland presumably watched them dine, then followed them back to their campsite. They were found 3 days later in their tents, with their hands bound and their throats cut. There was no apparent motive. There has never been a suspect. Their deaths will almost certainly forever be a mystery. Of course, I had no idea of this at the time, so when Katz and Connolly caught up, I simply observed to them what a lovely spot it was. They looked at it and agreed, and then we moved on. We had lunch with Connolly at Skyland, and then he left us to hitchhike back to his car at Rockfish Gap and return home. Katz and I bade him farewell and then pushed on, for that was what we did. We walked for 3 days more, stopping at restaurants when we came to them, and camping in shelters, which once again we had mostly to ourselves. On our next to last day in the park, our sixth since setting off from Rockfish Gap, we awoke to chill, gloomy weather. The wind freshened, and then it began to rain, steadily and heavily, a really cold, penetrating rain. It turned out to be an awful day in nearly every way. In the early afternoon, I discovered that I had lost my backpack rain cover, which, may I just say here, was a completely useless, ill-designed piece of crap anyway, for which I had paid $25, and that nearly everything in my pack now ranged from sodden to damp. I had, fortunately, taken to wrapping my sleeping bag in a double thickness of trash bags, cost 35 cents, so it at least was dry. 20 minutes later, as I sheltered under a bough waiting for Katz, he arrived and immediately said,
"Hey, where's your stick?"
I had lost my beloved walking stick. I suddenly remembered propping it against a tree when I had stopped to tie a lace and was filled with despair. That stick had seen me through 6.5 weeks of mountains, had become all but part of me. It was a link with my children, whom I missed more than I can tell you. I felt like weeping. I told Katz where I thought I'd left it, at a place called Elk Wallow Gap, about 4 miles back.
"I'll get it for you," he said without hesitation, and started to drop his pack.
I could have wept again. He really meant it, but I wouldn't let him go. It was too far. And besides, Elk Wallow Gap was a public place. Someone would have taken it as a souvenir by now. So we pressed on to a spot called Gravel Springs Hut. It was only 2:30 when we got there. We had planned to go at least 6 miles further, but we were so soaked, and the rain was so unrelenting, that we decided to stop. I had no dry clothes, so I stripped to my boxer shorts and climbed into my sleeping bag. We spent the longest afternoon I can ever remember listlessly reading and staring out at the pattering rain. At about 5:00, just to make our day complete, a group of 6 noisy people arrived, 3 men and 3 women, dressed in the most preposterously Ralph Lauren-style hiking clothes, safari jackets and broad-brimmed canvas hats and suede hiking boots. These were clothes for sauntering along the veranda in Mackinac, or perhaps going on a jeep safari, but patently not for hiking. One of the women, arriving a few paces behind the others and walking through the mud as if it were radioactive, peered into the shelter at me and Katz and said with undisguised distaste,
"Oh, do we have to share?"
They were, to a degree that would have been fascinating in less trying circumstances, stupid, obnoxious, cheerfully but astonishingly self-absorbed, and not remotely acquainted with trail etiquette. Katz and I found ourselves carelessly bumped and jostled into the darkest corners, sprayed with water from clothes being shaken out, and knocked on the head with casually discarded equipment. In astonishment, we watched as clothes we had hung up to dry on a small clothesline were pushed and bunched to one side to make abundant room for their stuff. I sat sullenly, unable to concentrate on my book, while 2 of the men crouched beside me in my light and had the following conversation.
"I've never done this before."
"What, camp in a shelter?"
"No, look through binoculars with my glasses on."
"Oh,
I thought you meant camp in a shelter. No, I meant look through binoculars with my glasses on. After about a half an hour of this, Katz came over, knelt beside me, and said in a whisper, "One of these guys just called me sport. I'm getting the fuck out of here." "What are you going to do?" "Pitch my tent in the clearing. You coming?" "I'm in my underpants," I said pathetically. Katz nodded in understanding and stood up. "Ladies and gentlemen," he announced, "can I have your attention for a minute? Excuse me, sport, can I have your attention? We're going to go out and pitch our tents in the rain, so you can have all the space in here. But my friend here is in his boxer shorts and is afraid of offending the ladies, and maybe exciting the gentlemen," he added with a brief, sweet leer. "So could you turn your heads for a minute while he puts his wet clothes back on? Meanwhile, I'll say goodbye and thank you for allowing us to share a few inches of your space for a little while. It's been a slice." Then he jumped down into the rain. I dressed hastily, surrounded by silence and self-consciously averted gazes, then bounded down with a small, wimply neutral goodbye. We pitched our tents about 30 yards away. Not an easy or enjoyable process in the driving rain, believe me, and climbed in. Before we had finished, voices from the shelter had resumed and were succeeded by peals of triumphant laughter. They were noisy until dark, then drunkenly noisy until the small hours. I wondered if at any point they would experience some twinge of charity or remorse and send over a peace offering, a brownie perhaps, or a hot dog, but they did not. When we woke in the morning, the rain had stopped, though the world was still insipid and drear, and water was dripping from the trees. We didn't bother with coffee. We just wanted to get out of there. We broke down our tents and packed away our stuff. Katz went to get a shirt from the line and reported that our six friends were sleeping heavily. There were two empty bourbon bottles, he reported in a tone of disdain. We hefted our packs and set off down the trail. We had walked perhaps 400 yards, out of sight of the camp, when Kat stopped me. "You know that woman who said, 'Ooh, do we have to share,' and shoved our clothes to the end of the clothesline?" he asked. I nodded. Of course I remembered her. "Well, I'm not real proud of this. I want you to understand that. But when I went to get my shirt, I noticed her boots were right by the edge of the platform. And, well, I did something kind of bad." "What?" I tried to imagine, but couldn't. He opened his hand, and there were two suede shoelaces. Then he beamed, a big, winning beam, and stuck them in his pocket and walked on. Chapter 13. And that was about it for the start of our great adventure. We walked 18 miles to Front Royal, where my wife was to pick us up in 2 days if she managed to find her way by car from New Hampshire in an unfamiliar country. I had to go off for a month to do other things. Principally, try to persuade Americans to buy a book of mine, even though it had nothing to do with effortless weight loss, running with wolves, thriving in an age of anxiety, or the O.J. Simpson trial. Even so, it sold over 60 copies. Katz was going back to Des Moines, where he had the offer of a job for the summer, building houses, though he promised to come back in August and hike the famous and forbidding 100-mile wilderness in Maine with me. At one point, very early in the trip, he had talked earnestly of doing the whole trail, pushing on alone until I was able to rejoin him in June. But when I mentioned this now, he just gave a hollow laugh and invited me to join him in the real world when I felt up to it. "To tell you the truth, I'm amazed we've come this far," he said, and he was right. We had hiked 500 miles, 1.25 million steps, since setting off from Amicalola. We had grounds to be proud. We were real hikers now. We had shit in the woods and slept with bears. We had become, we would forever be, mountain men. We reached Front Royal about 7, dead tired, and went to the first motel we came to. It was arrestingly dire, but cheap. The bed sagged. The TV picture jumped as if it were being mercilessly goosed by an electronic component. And my door didn't lock. It pretended to lock,
but if you pushed on it from outside with a finger, it popped open. This perplexed me for a moment, until I realized that no one could possibly want any of my possessions. So I just pulled it shut and went off to find Katz and go to dinner. We ate at a steakhouse down the street and retired happily to our televisions and beds. In the morning, I went early to Kmart and bought two complete new sets of clothes. Socks, underwear, blue jeans, sneakers, handkerchiefs, and the two liveliest shirts I could find, one with boats and anchors, the other with a famous Monuments of Europe motif. I returned to the motel, presented Katz with half, he couldn't have been more thrilled, then went to my room and put on my new attire. We met in the motel car park 10 minutes later, looking crisp and stylish, and exchanged many flattering comments. With a day to kill, we went for breakfast, had an idle, contented saunter through the modest central business district, poked around in thrift shops for something to do, found a camping store, where I bought a replacement hiking stick exactly like the one I had lost, had lunch, and in the afternoon decided, naturally, to go for a walk. It was, after all, what we did. We found some railroad tracks which followed the stately curves of the Shenandoah River. There is nothing more agreeable, more pleasantly summery, than to stroll along railroad tracks in a new shirt. We walked without haste, or particular purpose, mountain men on holiday, chatting seamlessly about nothing in particular, stepping aside from time to time to let a freight train lumber past, and generally enjoying the abundant sunshine, the beckoning infinite gleam of silver track, and the simple pleasure of moving forward on legs that felt tireless. We walked almost till sunset. It was a happy way to conclude the trip. In the morning, we went to breakfast, and then there was the 3 hours of fidgety torture of standing at the edge of a motel drive, watching traffic, for a particular car filled with beaming, much-missed faces. Well, you can imagine the reunion scene, I'm sure. The exuberant hugs, the tumble of information about the confusion of finding the right turnoff and motel, the impressed appraisal of Dad's new body, the less impressed appraisal of his new shirt, the sudden remembering to include Katz, bashfully grinning on the margins in the celebrations, the tousling of hair, the whole transcendentally happy business of being back together. We took Katz to National Airport in Washington, where he was booked on a late afternoon flight to Des Moines. At the airport, I realized we were already in different universes. He in a where-do-I-go-to-check-in sort of distraction. I in the distraction of knowing that my family waited, that the car was badly parked, that it was nearly rush hour in Washington. So we parted awkwardly, almost absently, with hasty wishes for a good flight and promises to meet again in August. When he was gone, I felt bad. But then I turned to the car, saw my family, and didn't think about him again for weeks. It was the end of May, almost June, before I got back on the trail. I went for a walk in the woods near our home with a day pack containing a bottle of water, two peanut butter sandwiches, a map, for form's sake, and nothing else. It was summer now, so the woods were alive with green and heavy with birdsong and swarming mosquitoes and blackfly. I walked 5 miles over low hills through the woods to the town of Etna, where I sat beside an old cemetery and ate my sandwiches, then packed up and walked home. I was back before lunch. It didn't feel right at all. The next day, I drove to Mount Musilaki, 50 miles from my home on the southern edge of the White Mountains. Musilaki is a wonderful mountain, one of the most beautiful in New England, with a certain leonine grandeur and weighty majesty. But it is rather in the middle of nowhere, so it doesn't attract a great deal of attention. It belongs to Dartmouth College of Hanover, whose famous outing club has been looking after it in a commendably low-key way since the early years of this century. Dartmouth introduced the sport of downhill skiing to America on Musilaki, and the first national championships were held there in 1933. But it was too remote, and soon the sport in New England moved to other mountains nearer main highways, and Musilaki returned to a splendid obscurity. Today, You would never guess that it had ever known fame. I parked in a small dirt car park, the only car that day, and set off into the woods. This time I had water, peanut butter sandwiches, a map, and insect repellent. Mount Musilaki is 4,802 feet high and steep. Without a full pack, I walked straight up it without stopping, a novel and gratifying experience. The view from the top was gorgeously panoramic, but it still didn't feel right without cats, without a full pack. I was home by 4 p.m. This didn't feel right at all. You don't hike the Appalachian Trail and then go home and cut the grass. So I decided to return to the trail properly, far away from home. The problem was that it is almost impossible nearly everywhere along the AT to get on and off the trail without assistance. I could fly to Washington or Newark or Scranton or Wilkes-Barre or any of several other places in the region of the trail, but in each case, I would still be scores of miles short of the trail itself. I couldn't ask my wife to drive me back to Virginia or Pennsylvania any more than you could ask your wife to drop you in Dusseldorf, so I decided to drive myself. I would, I figured, park at a likely-looking spot, hike for a day or two into the hills, hike back, and drive on a bit. I suspected this would turn out to be fairly unsatisfying, possibly even imbecilic. And I was right on both counts, but I didn't have a better alternative. And thus I was to be found, in the first week of June, standing on the banks of the Shenandoah again, in Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Harper's Ferry is an interesting place, and for a number of reasons. First, it is quite pretty. This is because it is a national historical park, which means it is owned by the nation as a treasured monument. So there are no Pizza Huts, McDonald's, Burger Kings, or even residents, at least in the lower, older part of town. Instead, you get restored or recreated buildings with plaques and interpretation boards. So it doesn't have much or indeed any real life, but it still has a kind of polished prettiness. You can see that it would be a truly nice place to live if only people could be trusted to reside there without succumbing to the urge to have Pizza Huts and Taco Bells, and personally I believe they could, for up to 18 months. So instead, you get a pretend town, attractively tucked between steep hills at the confluence of the Shenandoah and Potomac Rivers. It is a national historical park because, of course, it is a historic place. It was at Harper's Ferry that the abolitionist John Brown decided to liberate America's slaves and set up a new nation of his own in northwestern Virginia, which was a pretty ambitious undertaking, considering that he had an army of just 21 people. To that end, on 16 October 1859, he and his little group stole into town under cover of darkness, captured the federal armory without resistance. It was guarded by a single night watchman, yet still managed to kill a hapless passerby, who was, ironically, a freed black slave. When news got out that a federal armory with 100,000 rifles and a great deal of ammunition was in the hands of a small band of lunatics, the president, James Buchanan, dispatched Lieutenant Colonel Robert E. Lee, at that time still a loyal Union soldier, to sort things out. It took Lee and his men less than 3 minutes of fighting to overcome the hapless rebellion. Brown was captured alive, swiftly tried, and sentenced to be hanged a month hence. One of the soldiers sent to oversee the hanging was Thomas J. Jackson, soon to become famous as Stonewall Jackson, and one of the eager onlookers in the crowd was John Wilkes Booth. So the capture of the federal armory at Harper's Ferry served as quite a neat overture for all that followed. Meanwhile, in the wake of Brown's little adventure, all hell was breaking loose. Northern abolitionists like Ralph Waldo Emerson made Brown a martyr, and Southern loyalists got up in arms, quite literally, at the idea that this might be the start of a trend. Before you knew it, the nation was at war. Harper's Ferry remained at the center of things throughout the wildly bloody conflict that followed. Gettysburg was just 30 miles to the north, Manassas a similar distance to the south, and Antietam, where it is worth noting twice as many men died in one day as the total American losses in the War of 1812, Mexican War, and Spanish-American War combined, was just 10 miles away. Harper's Ferry itself changed hands 8 times during the war, though the record in this regard belongs to Winchester, Virginia, a few miles south, which managed to be captured and recaptured 75 times. These days, Harper's Ferry passes its time accommodating tourists and cleaning up after floods. With 2 temperamental rivers at its feet and a natural funnel of bluffs before and behind, it is forever being inundated. There had been a bad flood in the town 6 months before, and the park staff were still busy mopping out, repainting, and carrying furnishings, artifacts, and displays down from upstairs storage rooms. 3 months after my visit, they would have to take everything back up again. At one of the houses, 2 of the rangers came out of the door and down the walk and nodded smiles at me as they passed. Both of them, I noticed, were packing sidearms. Goodness knows what the world is coming to when park rangers carry service revolvers. I had a poke around the town, but nearly every building I went to had a locked door and a notice saying closed for flood repairs. Then I went and looked at the spot where the 2 rivers flow together. There was an Appalachian Trail notice board there. Although it had been only about 10 days since the 2 women were murdered in Shenandoah National Park, there was already a small poster appealing for information. It had color photographs of them both. They were clearly photos taken by the women themselves along the trail, in hiking gear, looking happy and healthy, radiant even. It was hard to look at them, knowing their doom. It occurred to me with a small inward start that had the 2 women lived, they would very probably be arriving in Harper's Ferry just about now. That instead of standing here looking at a poster of them, I could be chatting with them. Or indeed, given a slight alteration of luck and fate, that it could be they looking at a poster of me and Katz, looking trail-happy and confident. In one of the few houses open, I found a friendly, well-informed, happily unarmed ranger named David Fox, who seemed surprised and pleased to have a visitor. He bobbed up instantly from his stool when I came in and was clearly eager to answer any questions. We got to talking about preservation, and he mentioned how hard it was for the Park Service, with so few funds, to do a proper job. When the park had been formed, there had been money enough to buy only about half of the Schoolhouse Ridge battlefield above town, one of the most important, if least celebrated, of Civil War battle sites. And now a developer was in the process of building houses and shops on what Fox clearly saw as hallowed ground. The developer had even started running pipes across National Park land in the confident, but as it happened, mistaken presumption that the Park Service wouldn't have the will or money to stop him. Fox told me I should go up and look at it. I said I would. But first, I had a more important pilgrimage to make. Harper's Ferry is the headquarters of the Appalachian Trail Conference, overseers of the noble footpath to which I had dedicated my summer. The ATC occupies a modest white house on a steep hill above the old part of town. I trudged up and went in. The HQ was half office, half shop, the office portion commendably busy-looking, the shop half arrayed with AT guides and keepsakes. At one end of the public area was a large-scale model of the entire trail, which, had I seen it before I started, would very possibly have dissuaded me from attempting such an undertaking. It was perhaps 15 feet long, and conveyed instantly and arrestingly what a hard hike the AT is. The rest of the public area was filled with AT goods, T-shirts, postcards, bandanas, books, miscellaneous publications. I chose a couple of books and some postcards, and was served at the counter by a friendly young woman named Laurie Pottinger, whose label described her as an information specialist. And they seemed to have chosen the right person, for she was a mine of information. She told me that the previous year, 1,500 prospective thru-hikers had started the trail. 1,200 had made it to Neal's Gap. That's a dropout rate of 20% in the first week, from a core of people who had intended to hike for 5 or 6 months. About 1/3 had made it to Harper's Ferry,
roughly halfway, and about 300 had reached Katahdin, a higher success rate than usual. 60 or so people had successfully hiked the trail from north to south. This year's crop of thru-hikers had been passing through for the past month. It was too early to say what the final figure for the year would be, but it would certainly be higher. It rose, in any case, almost every year. I asked her about the dangers of the trail, and she told me that in the 8 years she had worked for the ATC, there had been just 2 confirmed cases of snake bite, neither fatal, and 1 person killed by lightning. I asked her about the recent murders. She gave a grimace. It's awful. Everyone's really upset about it, because trust is such a kind of bedrock part of hiking the AT, you know? I thru-hiked myself in 1987, so I know how much you come to rely on the goodness of strangers. The trail is really all about that, isn't it? And to have that taken away, well... Then, remembering her position, she gave me a little bit of the official line. A brief, practiced, articulate spiel to the effect that one should never forget that the trail is not insulated from the larger ills of society, but that statistically it remains extremely safe, compared with most places in America. It's had 9 murders since 1937, about the same as you would get in many small towns. This was correct, but a wee bit disingenuous. The AT had no murders in its first 36 years, and 9 in the past 22. Still, her larger point was unarguable. You are more likely to be murdered in your bed in America than on the AT. Or, as an American friend put it to me much later, look, if you draw a 2,000-mile-long line across the United States at any angle, it's going to pass through 9 murder victims. If you're interested, there's a book about one of the murders, she said, and reached below the counter. She rooted for a moment in a box and brought out a paperback called 8 Bullets, which she passed to me for examination. It was about 2 women who were shot in Pennsylvania in 1988. We don't keep it out because, you know, it's kind of upsetting, especially now, she said apologetically. I bought it, and as she handed me my change, I mentioned to her the thought that if the women had survived, they would be passing through about now. Yeah, she said. I'd thought about that. It was drizzling when I stepped back outside. I went up to Schoolhouse Ridge to have a look at the battlefield. It was a large park-like hilltop with a wandering path lined at intervals with information boards describing charges and last-ditch stands and other confused, noisy action. The battle for Harper's Ferry was the finest moment for Stonewall Jackson, he who had last come to town to hang John Brown, because it was here, through some deft maneuvering and a bit of luck, that he managed to capture 12,500 Union troops, more American soldiers than would be captured in a single action until Bataan and Corregidor in the Second World War. Now, Stonewall Jackson is a man worth taking an interest in. Few people in history have achieved greater fame in a shorter period with less useful activity in the brain box than General Thomas J. Jackson. His idiosyncrasies were legendary. He was hopelessly, but inventively, hypochondriacal. One of his more engaging physiological beliefs was that one arm was bigger than the other, and in consequence, he always walked and rode with that arm held straight up, so that his blood would drain into his body. He was a champion sleeper. More than once he fell asleep at the dinner table with food in his mouth. At the Battle of White Oak Swamp, his lieutenants found it all but impossible to rouse him, and lifted him, insensible, onto his horse, where he continued to slumber while shells exploded around him. His obtuseness was famed. Once when a celebrated singer sang Dixie for him and his officers, then asked if he had any special requests, he told her he had just one. Would she sing Dixie for him? He showed excessive zeal in recording captured goods, and would defend them at all costs. His list of material liberated from the Union Army during the 1862 Shenandoah campaign included, quote, 6 handkerchiefs, 2¾ dozen neckties, and 1 bottle of red ink, unquote. He constantly drove his superiors, fellow commanders, and junior officers to enraged frustration, partly by repeatedly disobeying instructions, and partly by his paranoid habit of refusing to divulge his strategies, such as they were, to anyone. One officer under his command was ordered to withdraw from the town of Gordonsville, where he was on the brink of a signal victory, and march at the double to Staunton. Arriving in Staunton, he found fresh orders to go at once to Mount Crawford. There, he was told to return to Gordonsville. It was largely because of his habit of marching troops all over the Shenandoah Valley in an illogical and inexplicable fashion that Jackson earned a reputation among bewildered enemy officers for wiliness. His ineradicable fame rests almost entirely on the fact that he had a couple of small victories when other Southern troops were being slaughtered and routed, and by dint of having the best nickname any soldier has ever enjoyed. He was unquestionably brave, but in fact it is altogether possible that he was given that nickname not for gallantry and daring, but for standing inert like a stone wall when a charge was called for. General Bernard Bee, who gave him the name at the First Battle of Manassas, was killed before the day was out, so the matter will remain forever unresolvable. His victory at Harper's Ferry, the greatest triumph for the Confederacy in the Civil War, was almost entirely because for once he followed the instructions of Robert E. Lee. It sealed his fame. A few months later, he was accidentally shot by his own troops at the Battle of Chancellorsville and died 8 days later. The war was barely half over. He was just 39. Jackson spent much of the war in and around the Blue Ridge Mountains, camping in and marching through the very woods and high gaps through which Katz and I had lately passed, so I was interested to see the scene of his greatest triumph, and followed the path around the undulating field, reading the information boards with dutiful attention, and peering unsuccessfully through the trees for a sign of the new housing development. It was late, and the light was going. And anyway, to be perfectly frank, I have never been much good at battlefields. It was, I suppose, theoretically interesting to know that Captain Pogue's battery stood just here, and Colonel Grigsby's troops were arrayed in a thin, wavery line over there, but really, there was no getting around the fact that today it is just a pleasant, grassy field on a West Virginia hill. I was hungry and had driven a long way, so I didn't have the necessary energy to imagine the noise and smoke and carnage. Besides, I had had enough death for one day. So I tramped back to the car and continued on. End of Side 5.